So we're in Luke, in the travel narrative, Jesus going from up north in the Galilee down to Jerusalem. This is another very familiar tale about Jericho, which is very close to Jerusalem. We hear what the Spirit is saying to the church. Jesus entered Jericho and was passing through it. A man there named Zacchaeus was a chief tax collector, and he was rich. He was trying to see who Jesus was, but on account of the crowd, he could not because he was short in stature. So Zacchaeus ran ahead, climbed a sycamore tree to see Jesus because Jesus was going to pass that way. When Jesus came to the place, he looked up and he said to him, "Zacchaeus, hurry, come down. I must stay at your house today." So Zacchaeus hurried down and was happy to welcome Jesus. And all who saw it began to grumble and say, "Jesus has gone to be the guest of one who was a sinner." Zacchaeus stood there and he said to the Lord, "Look, half of my possessions, Lord, I will give to the poor. And if I have defrauded anyone of anything, I will pay back four times as much." And then Jesus said to Zacchaeus, "Today salvation has come to this house, because he too is a son of Abraham. For the Son of Man came to seek out and to save the lost." The Gospel of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
So this past Tuesday, 4 p.m., I showed up as scheduled for my annual flu shot. I'm in close proximity to too many people with all sorts of infectious diseases, so I get my flu shot every year. And then, right on schedule, about 41st hour on Thursday, I suddenly got like this runny nose, a little bit of, well, once in a while, a little bit of a cough, and it's like, you just get this stuff in the throat and everything. It's like, that's great. Right within the 48 hour, right on schedule, that's when you get the side effects. Well, you can get lots of other side effects. But the good news is that then I researched, so how long is this going to last? And my students tell me that everything on the internet is true, and I read on the internet that it lasts 3 days. So that means this means that this afternoon at 4 o'clock, I'll be all back to normal again. Now, I don't think I'm infectious or anything. I just deal with these side effects. But I just add a little more distance here, just so no one gets excited. Now, Zacchaeus, we're looking at Zacchaeus. Yeah, so, you know, this often gets to be kind of a domesticated tale, very tame. There was this short little guy, this little tax collector, and he really wanted to see Jesus, and so he couldn't see, so he ran down the street, and he climbed a tree, and then he could see Jesus, and then they had dinner together, and blah, blah, blah. It's a very domesticated a way to tell the story. But the story tells us, it says that Zacchaeus was the chief tax collector and was rich. Well, that's a mouthful there that we just skip over. So a tax collector, you have an outside empire. You have the Romans who have occupied your land and they want money. So you decide, you do as you would like to be what they call a tax farmer, because they don't want to be engaged in collecting the taxes. That's going to stir up the peasantry. So you pay off the Roman Empire, and you have the privilege of being the tax farmer or the tax collector. If anybody hassles you, you have the might of Rome behind you. So you always have to say, if you don't want to pay, I just call in the big boys here from Rome. Tax collectors, by definition, are rich, so that's kind of redundant to say that he was a tax collector who was rich. All tax collectors are rich because there's no set schedule. There isn't any set fees. You just eyeball the crowd as they're coming along the road from Jericho on up to Jerusalem, and you charge what you want to charge. You can extract from people a little bit or a lot of it or a whole lot of it. So this is not a good situation here. He is not someone who's going to be regarded well in the eyes of the people of that land. Now, it says he's a chief tax collector. So he's the head honcho. Now, who's he making money off of? He's making money off his own people, his own flesh and blood, his own sisters and brothers. He charges whatever he wants. He's an extortionist, basically, of his own clan. So that puts him in the category of a betrayer. You see, Zacchaeus coming, nobody's going to make room for him in the parade route. He's going to be ostracized, shut out. There's no one who wants to interact with him. He is a betrayer, betrayer. So he gets to go into the rogues gallery of famous betrayers throughout history. You know, people like Brutus, okay, who was a confidant, a noble Roman senator, an intimate friend of Caesar and whatnot, but he was manipulated by Cassius and he became part of a plot to assassinate Caesar with his famous words, et tu, Brute. You, of all people, I wouldn't expect that he's a famous betrayer. You might have, say, a Doña Marina, who was of Aztec birth, but who sold out to the cruel Spanish conquistadors when they came across the Atlantic Ocean. And she surreptitiously worked with Cortez to exterminate the Aztec people. She is a betrayer of all betrayers. She is known as La Miche. And so her name is just reviled in the Hispanic world. Maybe she's at the top of the list. In American history, we have our own probably number one betrayer of all, the Battle of Saratoga. Maybe the pivot point of the whole American War for Independence, or else we'd still be speaking the King's English, was Benedict Arnold. Courageous, brilliant general. But at the end of the war, he's commanding British troops, right? Because he concocted a plot with another British soldier to basically allow the British to capture West Point. And that failed, and he was able to escape. But his name is associated with the betrayer of all betrayers. You can say somebody was a Benedict Arnold. There's a whole rogues gallery of people. Well, of course, by the end of this tale, we're going to bump into Judas. Maybe no one is reviled more than Judas, or that you could probably use the word or the name Judas in many different cultural contexts if there was any kind of Christian background, that someone was playing the role of Judas. Somebody betrayed somebody else, right? Now, nice people were not, they were not enemies. That's what's key here. None of these people are enemies. They are not known quantities. They are not people, an enemy is someone who you know wants your head. They will do anything and everything to get your head. They will attack you. They will assault you. They will come at you frontally. That's what enemies are. You know they're an adversary, they're opponent, they're antagonistic, they're identifiable. So in conflict zones or wars, you could say they typically have different colors and styles of guard, right? So you know who they are. They're identifiable. And they're public about it. We know who the public enemies of the United States are, right? We know who the public enemies of different people are, even within our communities. It's a known quantity. So you need to keep distant from those people, and if you're in their presence, you need to have your head on a swivel and you need to protect yourself. But then there's a whole lot of other people from whom you need to keep distance and protect yourself, but you don't realize it because they dress in the same styles and colors as do you. These are your trusted friends, neighbors, co-workers, colleagues, partners, relatives, family members, people you go in family outings with, maybe go to the ball game, you might share some personal secrets with. These are trusted people. But then you see the daylight of truth suddenly shines, and you discover, wow, they're true colors. They're not people to be trusted. Their true colors is that these people are betrayers. These people are double agents. These people are doing double dealing here. These are people who are surreptitiously not coming at you from the front. They come on the flank, and they especially going to come from the rear. They're going to be instigators of plots to oust you from whatever situation you're in. whether it's a role or a job. These are people who will spread vicious rumors about your character. These are people who will assassinate your personality. These are people who will motivate other people to gang up and oppose you. Betrayers leave behind them a trail of pain and hurt, bruising, wounding, and they usually just walk off into the sunset. Now, when you discover this, your first sense is, it can't be true, because this is an intimate confidant. These are people whom you trust. So usually the first phase is one of total shock, disbelief, denial. It's not possible. But then eventually there's enough evidence that comes to the fore, and then you start to get a little puzzled and bewildered, like, I can't understand why. How could that possibly be? I didn't see any telltale signs. Did I say something? Did I do something? What could motivate this person to want to backstab me? I can't understand. Then, of course, at some point, the hurt, the pain is going to settle in. That's where then we start to get down to the nuts and bolts here. Now we start to get into anger. Anger because now you realize you've lost a friend, you've lost a colleague, the relationship has been broken, you're now in separate spheres. You now have your own psyche, your own body, mind, and soul called into question. Who are you? What am I? You also have now no sense of trust for future relationships. This very close relationship or relationships have turned upside down and bitten you in the back. Who are you going to trust in the future? Oh, betrayers are far worse than enemies. Far worse. Because the enemies, you know they're going to try to do you in, but a betrayer is the worst of the worst of the worst. That's what Zacchaeus is. That's what we miss in this story. This is a person who is the worst of the worst. This person is worse than the Romans. They're identifiable enemies. They dress different, talk different, walk different. This is Zacchaeus. He's one of them. He's one of the people. But he has sold out, and he is now profiting off his own blood, his own family relationships. Not only that, he is the chief tax collector. He has risen to the pinnacle. Now, he runs ahead, he climbs a tree to see Jesus, because Jesus is going to pass that way, right? We advance the story. Now the pivot, the key of the whole story now, the turning point. Jesus comes to the tree. Now what's he going to do? People who betray are borderline unforgivable. I mean, they have done, an enemy, you knew they were going to try to get you. A betrayer, they have perhaps destroyed your life, your career, your job, your character. Jesus comes to Zacchaeus, and you can feel the tension in the air here. He looks up, and he says to Zacchaeus, "Hurry, come down, I must stay at your house today." You couldn't think of anything more diametrically opposed, more unexpected for Jesus to invite himself into a meal with the betrayer of all betrayers of our community? Now, the English says, well, Zacchaeus hurried down. He was happy. Ah, I bet he was, because pretty much is reviled by everybody else. All who saw it began to grumble. So, not to get too deep into this, but the word is diagogazoon in the Greek. If you just say it, diagogazoon, they are grumbling. They're not murmuring. They are outraged. You can just hear, "Oh my God, what's Jesus doing?" Now, preceding these tales, or this tale, are tales about Jesus' teaching and preaching and healings and so on. Yeah, people want to see who he is. He comes, probably most people have never seen him before. First experience they have with him is he invites himself into dinner with the betrayers in the town. They are hostile. They are outraged. Frankly, now Jesus and Zacchaeus are at the risk of mob violence here. All who saw it began to become outraged, and they said, Jesus has gone to be the guest of one who is a sinner. And then, of course, it gets nicely tied up with a bow on it, doesn't it? Because then Zacchaeus looks around and he says, look, I'm going to give half of my possessions away to the poor. And then he says, I will pay back four times anyone if I defrauded anyone. What do you mean, if you defrauded anyone? You defrauded almost every customer. But the law requires you to pay back double. He says, I'll pay back four. So he is trying to way overcompensate. He recognizes this is a tense situation, and he needs to somehow lower the temperature and defuse it here. And then, of course, you know, seeking and saving the lost. So we often say, you know, forgiveness precedes repentance. And that goes by, because down deep, when someone does us dirt, we want them to apologize. We want them to repent. We want them to come to us on bended knee and say, I'm sorry I did such and such. Very infrequently would it ever be in our heart or mind to say, I will go to the person who did me dirt and I will say, you're forgiven. That's just really hard to do. And we're dealing here with a betrayer, not the enemies. A betrayer who has possibly destroyed your life. Yeah, and I'm going to go and forgive them first. That's a rugged book here, isn't it? It is a rugged book. Hate cannot drive out hate, though, right? Only love can drive out hate. And that's something that this whole country could benefit from saying again and again and again and again. So much hatred around us about all sorts of real and imagined acts, thoughts. Hate will not drive out that hatred. Maybe you touch somebody's life in the next day or two or three. Love can drive out hate. Jesus knew that, and this is just one of many, many stories where he doesn't react to something that's unforgivable and retaliate. His first move is to forgive, to extend the hand of forgiveness and love in the name of Christ.